morning. Welcome to the House Committee on Higher Education, Innovation, and Workforce Development. We have an agenda that's looks much more crowded than is actually going to turn out to be the case. So we are not going to hear House Bill 2952. We are going to carry over House Bill 2262, House Bill 2860, and House Bill 2870. And for the committee's benefit and anyone else, just to make clear, those are attractive relating to clauses that cover the span of our committee, and we're just keeping them alive in case something pops up in the last few days for us that we might want to use those for. So lest anyone else get nervous about that, that's the only purpose of those. Do you want to open a public? Sorry, Representative Reardon?
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
No problem. Sorry.
Agreeing with your wisdom.
Okay, thanks. So open a public hearing on House Bill 3075. This was a similar effort. We did get a piece of written testimony that I think is in the poll list.
Yes.
So keep that in mind. But we also want to make sure that this is available for some other efforts that are ongoing. Is there anyone who'd like to testify on House Bill 3075? Seeing none, close the public hearing on House Bill 3075.
Carry over the work session
On House Bill 3075 as well. Having done all of that, we can now proceed to open a work session on House Bill 2611.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2611 extends by 6 years the period during which universities with institutional governing boards must participate in mandated shared services under same terms, condition, funding, model, and policy framework as existed in 2013, declares an emergency as effective on passage. The proposed -2 amendments remove risk management from mandated shared service and specifies employee benefits to be continued.
Thank you. So we have those -2 amendments. Just to make clear what's available to us today, we don't have the paperwork. So if the committee decides to do so, we can adopt those amendments, but we can't go further than that. Do we think we want to take just
yes.
Okay. So Hans from University of Oregon, I understand you can come and help us explain or understand the -2 amendments, and you have a couple of colleagues who would like to come up as well. We'd be glad to hear from them. That's Andre LeDuc and Deb Downing, or Donning, I think I said it wrong.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, for the record, Hans Bernard with the University of Oregon. First, we want to start out by thanking the proponents of the bill for the opportunity to work on this language. As you will recall, the bill in its original form would stipulate that the universities stay in mandatory shared services as enumerated in the bill, including risk management, until 2021. Under the assumption that the law passed by this body in Senate Bill 270 was moving forward, the University of Oregon went through a process earlier this year to begin evaluating a risk management coverage outside of the university system and outside of the conglomeration with the other institutions. We were able to, through that process, identify that the university could expand our coverage and provide some savings to the University of Oregon in that effort, as well as provide an opportunity for the other institutions to evaluate their level of coverage, and they made some choices to expand their coverage as well. Andre and Deb here can talk about those changes or that process and walk through a memo that has been provided to the committee. Second, the second piece of the amendment clarifies and tightens the definition of benefits to stipulate that is PEB, PERS, and collective bargaining as enumerated in the original content of the bill. We wanted to make sure that those definitions were tighter and couldn't be construed in a broader format. There is a clause in the amendment that ensures that no watering down or backpedaling of any of those benefits could occur during the time period until 2021. Again, our thanks to the proponents of the bill for working through this amendment with us, and if the committee chooses to adopt it, the University of Oregon certainly believes that the bill is in much better shape moving forward. So I'll turn it over to Andre, who can walk you through our process a little bit, and then we'll be happy to answer any questions the committee might have.
Thanks, sir. Andre.
Chair Reed, members, for the record, my name is Andre LeDuc, Executive Director of Enterprise Risk Services at the University of Oregon, and Deb Donning with Risk Management and our Risk Manager for the University. So what we'd like to do today is kind of step you through the memo that kind of highlights our process, and as Hans mentioned, entertain any questions that you may have. Again, when we looked at different options for insuring the institution, with the option of kind of looking at both the pool and then going to the external market, we did that in a way that we wanted to make sure that we were being comprehensive in our coverage and also maximizing our choice and abilities to be good stewards, fiscal stewards for the institution. And so the first part that we did was not only looking internally at who and what we were within the pool, that being 24% of the allocation, but also trying to get market indications to see if it would be viable for us to go to the market independent. And what we found through a report that we had Brown & Brown do for us was that we could both be viable in the market on our own, but also that there would be limited or no impact to the pool and actually some benefits to the pool through the separation, and I'll kind of explain those as I step through. And so, in one of the elements that we were looking at is kind of coverage. And so, it's important to understand from a property standpoint for the whole system, we have roughly $8.7 billion of assets for all seven institutions. The university is $3 billion of those assets. One of the concerns that we've had for longstanding was the limitations and coverages that we have. And the one that I'll highlight would be earthquake, in the sense that we have $3 billion worth of assets covered with $500 million earthquake coverage with some limits of $100 million. That was something that concerned us both in the pool and one of the things that we looked at by going separate, that by going into our own coverage, we could maintain that $500 million and $100 million for our one institution. I don't have to tell you what it costs to replace a building. We have many buildings on campus that exceed $100 million. And so this is an example of, again, where we're able to maximize our ability of coverage without having a negative impact on the cost both to our institution or the others, in the sense meaning that by us separating, we're able to have broader coverage for things like earthquake, flood, and other coverages at relatively the same cost, but also then the other institutions that are still in the pool actually have one less group that's in the pool that would be demanding those resources. The other part, and why I use earthquake as a great example, is the likelihood or probability of an earthquake to hit the Oregon coast is pretty high sometime in the next 50 to 100 years. And so to honestly look at what the impacts would be to higher education statewide and how do we protect these assets. And so that's one example that was really important for us, is to look at how would we from the pool have ultimate coverage. The other key was looking at choice and customization over the coverages. And so when we were looking at our viability within the pool and the limitations of what we could or couldn't do, we saw that, again, that going our own way, we could maximize for our specific needs at our institution and yet, again, not impact negatively the other members of the pool, that they still have the choice to set their sublimits, their deductibles, and how they operate. And a good example there is in the past year, we increased our deductibles and our self-insured retention from $5,000 to $500,000. And again, what that does is puts more onus on us as an institution to better manage and mitigate our risk. And so it allows us to actually see rewards and kind of being proactive around risk. And again, when you think of one institution managing that versus seven, there's economy of scale, but there's also the difficulties of kind of one group taking a higher level of risk versus the other. And so kind of stepping through again, we didn't enter into this lightly. We wanted to make sure that, one, we would be viable in the market, and that was why we did the Brown and Brown study. The other part was we did also want to make sure that this would not have a negative impact to our other institutions. And this by no means also is not an indication that the U of O is not willing to or already actively partnering with the other higher ed institutions throughout the state. An example of that, another area that RISC oversees is emergency management. And in the past, the university has been the lead on securing federal funds to help develop mitigation plans for all campuses in the state. And we plan on continuing to do those type of collaborative activities. So again, the separation from kind of the RISC pool by no means is an indication of the U of O not being an active collaborative partner with our higher ed campuses, both public and private within the state, and believe that our history of kind of being proactive and trying to look at what's best for institutions of higher education will be something that we will continue to do. There's a lot of economy of scale. It's just how we package that economy of scale to make sure that we have maximum flexibility, choice for our campuses, and also look at a risk-reward system in the sense that allowing our campuses to kind of look at what risks and exposures we have and tailor the packages to those risks and exposures and hold people accountable to taking proactive measures to mitigate those risks. So then kind of in closing on the memo, the other part and why we appreciate the opportunity to come and talk to you is the way that the bill was originally drafted, we did take that option to separate based upon the information that we were able to glean both internally and then also from our third party. And so we have already secured a broker and a firm, meaning going to the market takes time. And so there's been a lot of transition in kind of how risk management is handled for higher education, starting all the way from the separation from DAS to going to the pool to moving towards now the opportunity that if institutions would choose that they could go independent. And so the reason that I bring that up is we are already well in the way of moving towards that independence and going to the market and looking at ways to best cover our campus in a comprehensive and customized package. I'm happy to entertain, or Deb or I are happy to entertain any questions that the committee may have.
Thank you, sir. Let's, Ms. Downing, anything to add, and then we can get to questions.
No, I have nothing to add. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Are there questions from the committee?
Representative Rudin, just for clarification, the changes you're talking about affect only the coverage for your physical assets, or are there other?
No, it's the complete insurance package, and so the separation is we will be securing our own property and liability coverage.
Go ahead.
Are you including health coverage for employees?
No. You want, no.
No.
So health coverage was still under everybody's same plan?
Okay. Correct.
That's right.
The way I read that, and please correct me if I'm wrong, it looks like I'm trying to, in real time, toggle back and forth between the amendment and the bill. It continues to say group insurance or deferred compensation plans are things that they're required to be part of it, and the risk management comes out from the list of things that are required. Is that, am I reading that right?
Chair Reed, members of the committee, to clarify, one of the reasons that we felt a need for the other pieces of the amendment other than the risk management removal from the bill was that in order to ensure that the universities would still be required to provide group health insurance in the manner currently provided, but allow flexibility in the financial arrangements for which those institutions are providing that benefit to the university employees. The example I would use is currently the seven university presidents, in a letter that you received at the first hearing on this bill, have collectively agreed to recommend to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission that $12.1 million of the Public University Support Fund off the top of that amount be included in the base funding for the regional and technical institutions to cover their shared services cost. What the original version of this bill would have done would be to require that those benefits be provided in the exact same financial manner as they were today. So this amendment adds some flexibility to allow, for example, in the example I just provided, the presidents to agree and the HEC to incorporate base funding for the regional and technical institutions to cover their costs for those benefits.
Thank you.
And just to make one final point on that question, Representative Reardon, that you'll note in the line 15 of the amendment, during the period the public university listed is providing shared administrative services, the public university may not decrease the scope or overall value of an employee benefit listed in subsection 1.
Okay, great. Thank you. I was having trouble going back and forth as well.
It's a challenge. Other questions? Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hans, or defer to the risk experts. So I'm not an insurance, but seems like, looking at the big picture, if one university decides not to go in that, that's going to affect the overall price for the people left in it, right? You got a pool of people that they're, you know, if one person says my risk of tsunami is less or my risk of earthquake is less, so I'm going to go out and see if I can do my own thing, but that then affects the price of the group left in, right? So this group that we contracted with, I'm still not sure how it's going to work, but and again, it's, we don't need to be in that detail, I think, but could you comment on that? And Mr. Chair, too, since it came up about the health benefits, the health benefits offered to the university employees, does that qualify under the Affordable Care Act as Cadillac plans? And what will the financial increase of that be to the universities? Thank you.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, I'll defer to Andre on the first question. On the second, I don't know if we have the folks here to answer that question, but I can certainly follow up with the committee as needed.
Yes, Mr. Chair, for state employees' insurance will qualify as a Cadillac plan, so there'll be additional charge next year for the insurance plans under the Affordable Care Act, a significant amount of money.
Thank you, Representative.
Mr. Leduc. Chair Reed, members, the question regarding the cost differential, that was one of the reasons that we wanted to, before making this choice of moving forward, of having a independent review of the market to see what would happen if, because the first question we wanted to answer would be viable as a separate entity to the private market, meaning could we get better pricing and get the same type of coverage. But also in that question that we posed to the market, knowing that we're 24% of the allocation of the pool, leaving 76% kind of in the pool, would there be a negative impact to them? And so what we found in our market evaluation was that, one, we could be looking at a cost savings for us without having a negative impact for the rest of the pool. So you're right in kind of the pool dynamics. There's a certain point at which if people pull out of the pool that then you see a negative. What we realized is, again, for us making that move, we would not see a negative impact to the pool. Now, the other key is choice, that both us independently, one of our reasons for going independent was choice and more comprehensive coverage around property and liability for our institution and the types of things we do. The pool still also has that choice. And so when I talk to the fact that the pool with us moving out actually sees an increase in how they divvy up the current insurance if they choose to stay at the same levels. Meaning, again, using the earthquake example, or if you look at the flood example, that now 500,000 or 500 million with sublimits of 100 million is over 6 institutions as opposed to 7. So they will see a little bit of an increase, but they actually see a lot of benefit that you have less people drawing down on those resources. And so I think it's important that, again, that's why we didn't take this lightly and we looked at to see not only would we be viable in the market independent, but what would be the impact to the rest of the pool if we separated.
Thank you very much. Now, I'm not sure I understand it all, but...
You're getting nods from Portland State Representative behind you, too.
Chair Reed, Representative Wisnett, if I may. Yep. I want to be very clear that when we look back on this hearing 1 year from now, there will be a demonstration that rates for the other institutions did go up slightly. And the reason for that is because the 6 other institutions chose to enhance their coverage. But that will associate with a rate increase.
They're going to buy more coverage.
Correct. But it was not due to the University of Oregon removing ourselves from that pool. But just in the interest of full disclosure, I wanted to make that on the record.
Appreciate that clarification. So one additional question on that study. Clearly, it considered the University of Oregon.
Did it also consider a similar decision from other universities down the road, or was it a sort of scenario one is status quo, scenario two is the status quo minus U of O? In other words, are we going to see other universities looking at similar studies, and does the pool break down at some point if other universities consider leaving?
So, Chairman Reed, I would say that there's a lot of variables in this, and one of those is what the market is going to do. Mm-hmm. And I'll let Deb kind of speak to this, too, that one of the things that we see is that, yes, at a certain point, the pool would break down. Part of the concept of having risk pools is you choose to kind of bond together because you have similar type risks. And so I think over the evolution of the risk pool is looking at what is the optimal risk pool for that group. And so the separation of, you know, whether it would be PSU, OSU, you still have a viable, and I'd turn to looking at other risk pools within the state, city, county insurance, and the way that we do things, that the key is in choice and looking at how you structure the risk pool and what the coverages are. But to be able to say that a year from now, if another institution would pull out, did our study look at that? No. What our study was looking at was, again, what the viability. So the first question was, would it be viable? Would we independently, our institution, be able to get the same price point and benefit? And the answer was, it looked yes. But again, that's dependent upon the market each year. Yep. But you could assemble the risk pool that you could have all the regional schools, you could have a conglomerate of the bigs. Again, there's so many variables. It depends on the year and what you're trying to cover.
And I guess to that point, it might be that a year from now, for some reason we can't anticipate, you might decide that the University of Oregon might want to be back in the pool, and there's nothing to prevent that from happening in the
Correct.
In the building.
Or, and I think what I'd point out there, again, that choice of looking at how we have an open discussion about what is the best
Right.
risk structure for institutions, meaning there could be many permutations. You could have a risk pool of three schools and a risk pool of five, but looking at what is the economy of scale and where do we get the most benefit and coverage for the institutions we're trying to protect.
Very helpful. Thank you.
Do you have anything to add?
Chair Reed, members, one thing I would add.
And if you could identify yourself for the record, since we haven't heard from you yet before. Thank
yes.
you.
Chair Reed and members, for the record, my name is Deb Donning. I'm the risk manager at the University of Oregon. What I would add to that is that the current membership, we were very open when we went out with Brown and Brown to do the analysis. The way the trust document is written for the pool, it also takes into consideration if they want to open that up to other higher ed institutions in the state. So you may, you know, they may be looking in a year exactly of are community colleges going to be, maybe University of Oregon wants to participate in a certain way. So the trust document did allow for multiple scenarios and ultimate flexibility for membership.
Okay, thank you. Representative Reardon.
Just real quick clarification on the numbers. You said, did I understand the total amount of coverage available was $500 million, and then there were sub-levels of $100 million, and did that apply to one institution or all institutions in the state? Or
Chair Reed and members, the $500 million is a limit for property, and that is shared amongst the seven institutions at this time. The sub-limits then are also shared amongst the seven institutions.
So we're not really over... I mean, you have $3 billion worth of assets just at U of O, so we're really not covering anywhere near our risk.
Chair Reed and members of the committee, my stance on this, and again, my background has been in disaster management and organizational resilience. For the record, I think that we are underinsured on our earthquake risk as a whole for the state, and that when you do the math and you look at, yes, a $500 million shared across seven institutions, $8.7 billion of asset with sublimits of $100 million, or nowhere near the coverage we have, depending on, again, what our self-insured retention is as a state and how big our coffers are. If we had to dip into that, we can expect that post-earthquake, a significant earthquake event, we are going to have significant disruption to our higher ed institutions. That was a large driving force in looking at we needed to, meaning from the university, increase that coverage. And again, so what we've carried over is that $500 million, $1 million sub. And again, that's protecting $3 billion of asset. That's still insufficient, but it's a step in the right direction. And by us doing that, again, if the pool maintains their $500 million and $100 million sub limit for property, us not being in there now, it's six institutions. But yes, I believe that in my interpretation and what we found from everybody we've talked to, we are woefully uninsured under earthquake coverage. And our goal is to balance how much more can we buy with our resources that we have.
I think Mr. LeDuc is underselling his expertise on that question and being very diplomatic. If only our disruptions after an earthquake were limited to higher education. Representative Nierman and then Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Reed. So it seems like the scope of this bill is to require universities to share services so that we get economies of scale, yet sometimes that causes some problems. U of O wants to get out of the property and casualty pool and all that, and I get that, so we're kind of trading those things off. But look at the amendment, and the amendment says that you can't decrease the scope or overall value of employee benefits for 6 years. How does that fit into to getting an economy of scale, either for one university or for all of them or for anything? I mean, that seems kind of very incongruous for this, the entire idea of this bill.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, we worked very closely with the proponents of this bill. You will recall that when we were here before this committee earlier, the university raised significant concerns about the premise at the outset. I think what these amendments represent is a very collaborative, good faith effort to balance the needs of employees and the understandable desire for insurance assurances from university employees that their benefits continue to be provided at the level in which they have been provided in the past, yet provide the presidents and the boards of trustees and the management of the institutions with some additional flexibility. But I think you do raise the point that the Representative Nierman, that the premise of the bill is to provide assurances to employees that benefits will be continue to be provided to them at the level that they have, that has been provided in the past. That is something that, you know, the university is committed to. At the same time, we would like to preserve the greatest amount of flexibility possible moving forward. I would note that this bill, I think, is a one in many that we will continue to discuss that are issues that this body, the universities, the presidents, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, and others need to work through as we fundamentally continue to go through the process of restructuring higher education. Major legislation was passed by this body last session, and in the implementation of that legislation, there will continue to need to be episodic conversations on specific issues, and I think this bill is a classic example of that.
And I'll just follow up. I'll just say that I kind of feel like when you're talking about the breakup of the OUS and everything, which is I think what you're alluding to, that we need kind of maximum flexibility within sensible limits and all that. And this seems like, well, you just took all the fun out of collective bargaining for the next 6 years. So, not you personally, but whoever wrote the amendment or whoever worked that in.
Representative Nierman, I'm sure they'd welcome your presence at collective bargaining sessions. You can probably take part in some of that. So thank you for that. Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, it's a good conversation. It's not one we could have had prior to Senate Bill 270. I think that's important to get on the record, that this is exactly the type of conversations we were hoping we could have when we did away with the OUS system, empowered the independent boards to be able to have these conversations and make these determinations about how you can continue to provide the same level of good service, but perhaps do it at a more affordable price and so forth. So I appreciate that, because I would have been a no on the base bill, because I felt that was a step backward, I think, in the intent of what Senate Bill 270 was all about. So my question is on the amendments now. Do you feel that this gives you adequate flexibility as you go forward to do some things, i.e. like OHSU did a few years ago, where they redesigned their public employee benefit plan in a way that now is beginning to bend the cost curve on their employee costs to get away from what PERS was prior to what they have created it or amended it to be, that their employees can opt into this now, which is actually they like it. It's, you know, it's permissive. It's not a mandated thing, but it will lower the cost curve on their personnel long term. And going forward on health care, you feel like it gives you the creativity to, again, find other alternatives out there outside of PEB that can provide the same level of service for a reduced cost, perhaps, as long as you need still and work in a good faith relationship with your industry or with your university partners across the state.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, I think what today's conversation has demonstrated for me is that the quality of the conversation with the committee is much enhanced when the subject matter experts are present. So I would say that if we wanted to continue a conversation on the healthcare aspects of this bill, I would want to reach to the university and get the subject matter experts that could really provide the detail and granularity. That said, I think the bill provides limitations on the institutions, and I don't think that we can sit here and deny that. But with the presence of the independent boards, I think this bill does not preclude conversations and planning and thoughtful deliberation of what could be changed within or outside of the scope of the six-year timeline of the bill. You know, there is a part of me that thinks that with an assurance of a six-year timeline, that might provide a comfort level for all parties to come to the table and have some conversations to ensure that they could, everyone around the table could be comfortable with new offerings. I think the university is committed to continuing to provide quality healthcare for all of our employees and wanting to do that in the way that is the most cost-effective as possible. This bill does impose limitations on the institution, but I think it's a balance.
One quick follow-up. Does it take 6 years to generate that comfort? Could we not have it in 3 or 4?
Chair Reed, members of the committee, this was a delicate conversation with the proponents of the bill. I would be remiss to say if the University of Oregon would not prefer a shorter time frame on the scope of the bill, but we understand that the proponents need assurances.
Thank you.
I think we've taken care of the questions. Representative Gallegos.
I have a comment. I want to thank you, and I know this has been a lot of work and sort of working out the details and sort of working with the parties, but I do want to acknowledge that, you know, I think that organizational change takes time, and 6 years is a reasonable time. Usually organizations will take 3 to 5 years even just to change their mission statement. So I think that this really reflects the sufficient time in order to really review the changes, and if we need some flexibility, then we have it. So thank you.
Representative Gallegos, do you have a motion?
I do, actually. Chair Reed, I move to adopt the -2 amendments dated April 14th, 2015, and this relates to House Bill 2611-2.
Thank you. Representative Gallegos has moved the -2 amendments to House Bill 2611. They're dated April 14th, 2015. Is there any discussion of the motion? Representative Nierman.
I'll be objecting just based on my conversations here.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Hayden.
More of a comment. Thank you, Chair. My concern is in 2018, all of Oregon, but the universities particularly, will have an excise tax on their health insurance for individuals that is going to be a significant expense unless you have the flexibility to change something. There will be between a $4,000 to $6,000 cost at 40% for every individual that's insured on the health care as a requirement of the Affordable Care Act. I've asked a lot of questions about that and haven't gotten answers to what the plan is. So I think the six-year time frame would be more flexible if you had, after 2018, that flexibility. So because of the excise tax and not getting an answer back on how the universities and the state is going to handle that yet, I'll be opposed to it just from the time frame.
Okay. So Representative Wisden asked a similar question right before you left.
Okay. Sorry.
There was not a very specific answer yet, but just so you know, you're both thinking along the same lines. And again, the motion here is the adoption of the amendments. We don't have the paperwork yet to move the bill, but the motion is on the amendments. Acknowledging Representative Nierman's objection and Representative Hayden's objection, are there any other objections to the motion? Seeing none, the motion carries. The dash two amendments are adopted. And again, that's as far as we can go today. So to close the work session on House Bill 2611. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
And
thank
you for your testimony.
And
we'll carry over the work session. Thank you for the reminder to our Friday meeting, at which time we will hopefully have the paperwork for further consideration.
Maybe Mrs. Cox could be sure that we get a figure for the Cadillac cost on the for the Affordable Care Act to see what that's going to be.
We can certainly ask.
Yeah.
Yeah. No guarantees. I don't want to put Mrs. Cox in a position that she's.
Hans indicated there
every confidence in your capability, but that's not your area of expertise. I don't think.
I can't add.
So we can certainly make the inquiry.
I think it'd be good to have that number to see.
Appreciate that. Okay, so that then we'll move on to a work session on House Bill 3371. While you're giving us a summary, Victoria, Mr. Momsheimer, if you'd like to join us, we missed you last time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3371 prohibits retaliation against student of education program who makes good faith report regarding possible violation of state or federal law, rule, or regulation, creates private right of action, declares emergency as effective on passage. The proposed dash one amendments remove requirements for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to develop rules prohibiting retaliation against students.
Thank you. Committee, as you remember, we heard this bill, and Mr. Unger did a good job. I don't think I'm saying too much in saying that you wish that Mr. Momsheimer was here as well. He is now. So we have some written testimony from you, which I hope the committee's had a chance to review. We'd like to give you a chance to summarize that and add anything you'd like, and then I think the committee may have some questions for you.
Very good. Thank you, Chair Reed.
Thank you.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to come here today and testify in support of HB 3371. For the record, my name is Matt Malmsheimer. I'm a law partner with the firm Hagelin Kelly LLP. I'm here in my capacity as a concerned citizen who knows a little bit about the need for the bill and a little bit of the scope of it and how it would assist some Oregon students. I have a client who's currently facing a pretty difficult situation. She had gone through a professional degree, was pretty close to completing her studies, discovered what she believed to be some mishandling of financial aid funds, and approached the Oregon Attorney General about that. When the school found out about it, they initially suspended her pending what they decided was an investigation, and at the conclusion of that decided to expel her from school. And now my client is basically faced with student loan debt. Because she owed the school some money still on a promissory note for tuition, the school has retained her transcripts. And so now she not only has this student loan debt, but she can't get the license that she needs to pursue her calling. Fortunately, for my client, there is an avenue for us to correct this situation. That's the law that recently was enacted last year that brings employment law protections to student interns. She happened to be an intern at a on-campus facility. But were it not for that fortuity, in this situation, she really wouldn't have any recourse. I looked. There's really nothing that would have protected her at this point. The courts have interpreted the financial aid laws, while they require certain steps be taken by schools, there's no real, the trust relationship is between the financial aid provider and the school, not the school and the student. And the students under those laws don't have any avenue of saying, hey, they retaliated against me for this. Help me out. There's just nothing there. So I know that one of the concerns that some folks had raised is this going to be duplicative. Certainly there will be areas of law where it is duplicative. There are protections, obviously, for race and gender discrimination, but for a situation like this, and I'm certain there are others where we're talking about a whistleblower who's discovered some sort of what they believe to be illegal conduct and reported that and suffered retaliation, there aren't any protections that I'm aware of, and I've done a fair amount of looking into how we could correct such a situation. excuse me. I you know, don't have a whole lot more in terms of initial comments to make, but I'm happy to answer any questions that Chair Reed, you or any of the members of the committee might have.
Thank you very much. That's very helpful to have the context. Mr. Unger, would you like to give us a quick summary of the amendment, too, and then we can take some questions?
Certainly. Chair Reed, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Robert Unger. So the dash ones essentially remove Section 2, Sub 3, which requires HEC to do rulemaking. I think that was some of the issues that the committee had before was what would this require HEC to do? Would this create a large fiscal? And this would simply provide a private right of action under the law. So we feel that this would alleviate a lot of those concerns of the HEC, including their concerns that this would be an undue burden on them.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions for the panelists? Representative Nierman.
Thanks, Chair Reed. To the attorney, I'm sorry, I forgot your name.
Matt Malmstein.
Good. Thank you. So the client that you had that was expelled from school, what was the grounds for her expulsion?
They were very upfront about it, and it was about her report. I mean, basically the report and organizing some other students to address that.
So she was expelled from school because she complained about financial aid irregularities then, and that was the official grounds for the expulsion?
That's the letter that we received, yes.
Thank you.
Other questions? Let's see. Representative Gallegos?
Chair Reed, I move to adopt the dash one amendment stated April 13th, 2015.
Thank you. Representative Gallegos has moved the dash one amendments to House Bill 3371 that dated April 13th. Any discussion of the motion? Representative Nierman?
Thanks. I think the amendments improve the bill. I'm not sure if I'm happy with the bill even as amended, so I think I'll vote for the amendments.
You have a moment to consider your next options, I suppose. Okay, so seeing no objections, the motion carries and the dash one amendments are adopted to House Bill 3371. Representative Gallegos.
Chair Reed, I move House Bill 3371 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Gallegos has moved House Bill 3371 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's the legal definition or a good faith report? Can you?
Sure. The good faith report basically just means that the person who's making the report genuinely believes that what has occurred is illegal. The reason there is a distinction in the case law and in some statutes between a good faith report and a what's known as a reasonable report or reasonable understanding. The second distinction, a reasonable understanding, basically asks the reporting party to, in a sense, have a greater understanding of the law than they might. It requires that whether or not they really believe that's a violation of the law, well, nobody in the reasonable mind would think that that was a violation of the law. And so certain reports, even though they're completely in good faith, the reporting party believes they would be a matter of...
So clarification, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
So you're saying that reasonable is a higher level than good faith?
It is.
In the courts?
Level. That's correct.
So... Follow up.
Go ahead.
So, if I just I think something, have nope, I've not done any investigation, that would qualify as a good report.
If you generally believe that it was a violation of law, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so we have the motion. Any other discussion? Any objections to the motion, which is to send the bill as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation? Representative Nierman, Representative Wisnett?
Yeah. Has the HEC weighed in on this? Are they in favor of this? Do they see any problem for the universities as far as more cases or more?
I can't speak for them. Dana's there. Yes, go ahead.
Members of the committee. So we spoke with HEC. With the dash ones, they were comfortable with the proposal. We also reached out to OSU, community colleges, and the Alliance of Independent Colleges and Universities. All were supportive.
Thank you for that.
So Representative Nierman is objecting, and I recognized you. I think you were wanting to speak rather than registering an objection.
Yes, sir.
Okay. So acknowledging Representative Nierman's objection, are there other objections to the motion? I don't see any. So the motion carries. House Bill 3371, as amended, will go to the floor with the due pass recommendation. I assume Representative Holvey would carry the bill.
Or Representative Buckley, actually.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We'll ask Representative Buckley to carry. Thank you very much. Close the work session on House Bill 3371. And that takes us to a work session on House Bill 3516. Victoria.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3516 requires each school obtaining approval from the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to offer academic degree to obtain bond or letter of credit annually demonstrating school is financially sound and capable of fulfilling commitments to students, establishes requirements for bonds and letters of credit, grants students right to bring claim against school bond or letter of credit if student suffers economic loss due to school's failure to provide educational services, establishes process for commission to place school or program on probation or to revoke approval for school to offer academic degrees. Proposed dash one amendments specify calculation formula for amount of bond or letter of credit.
Thank you. And do we need to hear from them? Did we already adopt the amendments? Ms. Richardson, do you want to bring us up to speed again? Thank you. We've heard that. I know we heard it on Friday and then Monday, and I'm just pushing back in my mind. Did we adopt the amendments already? No, we did not. Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dana Richardson, Deputy Director for Legislative and Policy Affairs at the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. I'll just briefly explain the dash one amendments to you, and it may be ringing a bell because when we left on Friday, we said we're going to do amendments like that, and this is what they do. So we replaced a couple references to the term economic loss with monetary loss to kind of constrain what that would cover. We've also replaced educational services with the word instruction so that we're not talking about the broader suite of services that might be provided, but really the course, the classroom instruction. And then, as I indicated when this bill was last before the committee, we worked with some of the institutions that would be impacted, and the it's on lines 2 through 5 of the dash one amendments. We've identified essentially, we think more accurately, the amount of the bond. So it would be based on a rolling, it would be equal to or less than a rolling annual average of prepaid tuition. So for instance, if you were offering kind of an expensive course or a program like nursing, and you had a cohort that tended to start really large and then not have subsequent enrollment in other terms, you wouldn't be held to this really large amount year round, but you'd be based, the surety amount would cover the average for the institution for the academic year. So that's what the dash one amendments would do.
Thank you. Any questions? We did hear, as you correctly noted, from some of the institutions when we first heard it, would you, at least one of them is here, and I imagine he will nod or shake his head based on your answer. How would you characterize their reaction to the amendments?
Miraculous.
Wow. He's nodding. Impressed. They're nodding. Okay, good.
You're going to take that one.
They like him. Okay. We appreciate that. Thank you. Representative Nierman.
Thanks, Ms. Richardson. I'm not understanding an amendment, the word less. Why less?
I think, Mr. Chair, Representative Nierman, I think there are some very small private schools where we wouldn't think it was appropriate to have a bond that's up to the full amount. We think that there may be some situations, and this would allow the commission some flexibility to set a much lower bond if that were appropriate.
Okay, I get it. So you're going to set the rate, but you
correct.
Could set it to less than the dollar amount of the entire rate. Okay.
Correct.
I get it.
Good amendment. Let's see any other questions? So thank you. Representative Gallegos.
Chair Reed, I move to adopt dash one amendments dated April 13th, 2015.
Thank you. Representative Gallegos moves the dash one amendments dated April 13th, 2015. Any discussion of the motion? Any objections to the motion? Seeing none, the motion carries, and the dash one amendments are adopted. We have all the paperwork that we need. Representative Gallegos.
Chair Reed, I move House Bill 3516 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Gallegos moves House Bill 3516 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion of that motion? Any objections? Seeing none, the motion carries. House Bill 3516 goes to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. We'll ask Representative Nathanson to carry, since it's her bill, and close the work session on House Bill 3516. We have carried everything over that we need to, and we're ready to go for Friday. Anything else for today, committee? Seeing none.
8:30 Friday.
Are we 8:30 Friday?
We can be. Do that?
We can do that? Yep. That's enough time?
I can add.
Okay, 8:30 on Friday.
8:30
nice work,
Friday.
Mr. Vice
Thank
Chair.
You.
We're adjourned until 8:30 on Friday.
You approved it.
We're adjourned until 8:30 on Friday.
You approved it.
Thank you.